The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Sex Out Loud is sponsored by Lilo, award-winning designers of the world's best pleasure objects.
Smart, sexy, kinky, fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Hi, welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We're live today, and so as usual, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-472-5788, 866-472-5788. And we also have this new 24-hour hotline, as it were, a voicemail line where you can leave your questions and comments for me about the show, whatever you want. That number is 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. And we've been getting some really great calls on that line, and we're going to feature them very soon. So I want to just do a brief shout out to Dixie De La Tour, who is the curator and founder of Body Storytelling. I made my main stage debut on Valentine's Day and told my first story, and it was amazing. It was really fun. People actually gave me a standing ovation, which was very generous and kind of them. And I can't wait to do it again. So if Body Storytelling comes to your city, and it's often in San Francisco, it's been in Seattle, LA, Chicago, you should definitely go see it. And eventually they are going to have a podcast of their own. So at some point you will be able to hear that story. I'll keep you posted. Coming up in April, I want to remind you, April 14th to the 17th, I'm going to be emceeing at the 2016 International Ms. Leather and Ms. Bootblack Contest. It is the largest gathering of leather women and other leather genders in the world. It happens in San Jose. And you do have to pre-register. There's no on-site registration. So go to imsl.org to find out more about it. I hope to see you there. Also in April, this is going to be confirmed, you know, like in 5 minutes, but I want you to hold the date because I'm going to be in Seattle, April 23rd, and I'm going to be in Portland, Oregon, April 24th and 25th. So no more details than that, but for my folks in the Pacific Northwest, please mark your calendars. I can't wait to be back up there. And of course, this summer is super busy already. July 22nd to the 23rd, I'm going to be keynoting at Poly Dallas Millennium at their second annual symposium, which is called Designer Relationships. So I'm going to be talking all about non-monogamy, and I'm going to be in Dallas, Texas, where I haven't been for a really long time. So I really look forward to that. And of course, in August, Sex Educator Bootcamp is coming to Woodhull's Sexual Freedom Summit. I am teaching my Sex Educator Bootcamp Level 2 and debuting Level 3. Man, are you ready for Level 3? Because it is going to be awesome. So there's a bunch of ways to register. You can register if you want to go to the summit and my boot camps, which are pre-cons before the conference, you register on the Woodhull site. And if you just want to come to my boot camps, which you can do, you register on this other Eventbrite site. And we're going to tweet out all of those links today. Isn't it amazing that we're gonna talk about my next guest now, because it's someone that I have known, although never met in person, for what's almost, I guess 20 years now. And that nicely parallels kind of one of the books we're going to talk about today. So let me tell you about her. Chris Matza is the author of Something Wrong With Her, a hybrid memoir published in 2014 and a companion piece to her most recent novel, Various Men Who Knew Us as Girls. She has authored over a dozen other books, mostly novels and collections of short fiction. She lives in the Midwest and is a professor in the program for writers at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Her first novel, How to Leave a Country, won the Penn Nelson Algren Award, judged by Studs Terkel and Grace Paley. Some of her other notable earlier titles include Your Name Here, Dog People, and Is It Sexual Harassment Yet? In 95 and 96, she was the co-editor of Chick Lit, Post-Feminist Fiction, and Chick Lit 2, anthologies of women's fiction which predate the book industry's use of the term chick lit as branding for a popular genre. And this new book, which we're going to talk about today, as I said, is a real-time memoir which chronicles the 25-year journey to reunite with a boy from her past. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks.
So you were the third person to ever publish my work in a book, which was Chick Lit 2, which I still have on my bookshelf. And also, Dog People is one of my favorite novels of all time. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
I love that book. Man, I go back to that book. I love that book of yours. Because I know you've written so many books, but Dog People is my favorite of yours. So I'm really glad to actually talk to you live so many years later. I want to give people a sense of what this memoir is like, because it really is unlike anything I've ever read. And so I want to just read a few descriptions about it before we dive into it. So the description on Amazon says, Something Wrong With Her is an astonishing real-time testimony of a couple's reconnection while and within the writing of this memoir and their candid wrestling with 30-year-old memories, questions, and regrets. And the writer Marion Winnick says, Something Wrong With Her is certainly the most unusual true love story you will ever read. Layering recollected scenes and psychological analysis with journals, emails, letters, yearbook inscriptions, excerpts from the author's past literary works, jazz metaphors, footnotes, and more. Chris Matza's indefatigable self-scrutiny creates an experience that verges on the psychedelic. I just love that title, because I did feel a little, as I was reading this book, that I was on some kind of trip and I hadn't been on that particular trip before. And I was a little disoriented. Like, I didn't know, I had to sort of figure out how to read it as I was getting into it.
How to write it.
And so you're going to start with a little piece of it. You're going to give us a taste of it. So whenever you're ready.
Right. This is just two pages that comes right after meeting my first husband. And so I lost my virginity. When I represented it in fiction, the loss of virginity was hopeful, as I probably was when I wrote the scene. And, of course, like anything else I'd learned, trombone playing, photography, writing, I assumed I would get better. But what did I feel? I felt success. I felt achievement. I could have been handed a diploma or an A on a term paper. I congratulated myself and gave no thanks or acknowledgement to my body. I don't remember my body feeling much except friction. And that's what our sex life remained. Except instead of upgrading or improving, it got worse. Fear had not been resolved. It just then took a different form. With my first husband, fear became pain, became a condition called vaginismus. Vaginismus is a condition which affects a woman's ability to engage in any form of vaginal penetration, including sexual penetration, insertion of tampons, and the penetration involved in gynecological examinations. This is the result of a conditioned muscle spasm. The reflex causes the muscles in the vagina to tense suddenly, which makes any kind of vaginal penetration, including sexual penetration, either painful or impossible. With the constant accessory of pain, for us, sex involved, quote, getting me ready. Then the pleasure of sex, at least for me, but maybe for him as well, was accomplishing it. So foreplay was a job that had to be done right. If it wasn't, and he tried to move to the next step too soon and met with the muscle's reflex, the spasm, the contraction, and my face wincing, my gasp of wait, he often lost his erection. Understandable, considering what he was dealing with. Needless to say, my dilemma that there was something wrong with me and my secret conclusion that it was frigidity had not abated. Was it better to keep trying? The stretches of time between trying became longer and longer. Did we ever talk about it? Not much. Not until an abysmal attempt at sex therapy 3 years later. Foreplay involved his finger in my vagina, his mouth on my breast, preceded by my fingers and mouth on his penis. No variation. His coming in my mouth was not considered, because that would be the end and no accomplishment would happen. With the specter of accomplishment hovering over us, I doubt he could have ejaculated during fellatio. But there might have been another reason he didn't. Once he told me about being drunk and going down on a lover in his first year back in the States after living in Brazil. He never tried that with me. He was also never drunk. He never asked. I never made a suggestion. I made an assumption because I had already read this from Erica Zhang. I tried. I put my best tongue forward and took the plunge. You'll get used to the smell, I told myself. I said to myself, self, you smell the same. But it was not much use. My nose felt like it had spent its entire life in there. I've been married to two men who were freakishly good about brushing and flossing their teeth and wouldn't go down on me. At one time, this pair of traits did actually seem parallel, did add up to an if A, then B form of logic to me. At some point in graduate school, I wrote in a notebook, vulva, medical word, pedendum, of which one ought to be ashamed. It hadn't come to me by osmosis. Where had I heard or read this? I wish I could say. Intellectually, I knew the inherent misogyny, the unrightness of the shame definitions from the moment I recorded one in a notebook, a notation which I remembered word for word without finding the page where I first wrote it until this year. I wouldn't back then, and for 30 years afterwards, admit the shame I actually agreed with, the shame with which I eventually consciously viewed myself.
Okay, we're diving right in here, people, just in case you hadn't noticed. There is a lot in this book, and that piece touches on lots of different pieces and threads throughout the book. We've got to take a commercial break already. It happened that fast. But when we come back, we're going to talk about that piece that Chris just read, as well as all the other things in this miraculous memoir, Something Wrong With Her. So stay with us, more with Chris Mazza when we return.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with author Chris Mazza, who just before the break shared a little piece of her memoir, Something Wrong With Her. And Chris, there's just a lot in this book because you've not only written a memoir, but you've gone back through like all of your novels. You've grabbed actual sections of them and you sort of revisit this fiction writing that you've done and reveal what real life events or people or feelings they were based on. So the story, your story, is really compelling. But also for writers to read this book, there's this fascinating look inside the mind of a writer and how we mine our life experiences and transform them into fiction. And I'm wondering if you... It seemed like you were looking at some of this fiction you had written with new eyes, like you had new insights in going back over it about some of the things that you may have been experiencing or trying to sort of wrestle with in the writing.
Oh, yes, very much so, because I often can't remember a real experience that might have gotten used in fiction, because you work on it in fiction so much longer than it took to even have the experience. You write it, you rewrite it, you revise it, you try to sell it, you have to revise it before the book comes out. It's just, you live with it such a long time that it becomes almost the real experience. But then looking at it after a period of 20 years, 25 years, I could see things that I couldn't specifically remember consciously doing, but that said something to me now about what I'd done, why I had done that. It isn't a literary analysis. It's a psychological analysis, as you say, like figuring out why I had changed things a certain way, figuring out why I'd used certain words. But there is another reason I did it. I didn't think that I should be trying to re-dramatize scenes that I'd already dramatized. I thought that it would be fake. It would feel fake because I would be trying to not do it the way I did it before and make it living and breathing. And I thought, I can't do that. I'd rather just let it live and breathe the way it did in fiction and then look at it. And that turned out to work a lot better.
I mean, it's a really fascinating structure. And then you also use journal entries that you actually wrote at the time. I mean, you saved a lot of paper, is all I have to say. you saved your journals. You saved letters that you wrote to other people, which you copied, which is really amazing.
Right.
But then at the same time, I'm struck, you know, almost off the bat that it feels all the more terrifying. I mean, how scary was it to put all of this out there in the world as a memoir?
Well, the parts of it that were scary were the parts that were happening while I wrote it. The reconnection with the person from my past and the confusion and trauma of that. The parts from my past, the 30-year-old parts, I didn't have any fears of that because other than reading my journals, I couldn't remember writing them. Some of them I could, a few of them. But I sometimes tell my students, you write a journal and look at it even in 10 years and you won't know what you're talking about because journal language is so personal and secret. That is, you don't explain anything to anybody. It's just for you, and you think you'll remember it forever. And I didn't. But I also knew that if I retyped those journals, I would change them. I would fix the spelling. I would shorten or use better words. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that. Sometimes my writing was just so, I don't know what the word for it is. It just got so hysterical, the handwriting that I was using, that I thought, this has just got to be done this way. And so it was a lot of, it was actually a lot of photo work because I scanned them and made JPEGs of them, and then I had to go through and change a few people's names and put it in a font that looked similar enough. So I was, I may have saved a lot of paper in my life, but this was a monumental document that was mostly these JPEGs.
And so you mentioned this, the book opens with you reconnecting from a person with a person from your past, and then your actual correspondence with him is woven throughout the narrative. I don't want to give away too much because there's a lot of twists and turns, and readers, you've got to read it to figure out what happens. But let's talk about who Mark is, his significance in your life, and how he became a catalyst for you writing this book.
Well, I had met Mark, we met when we were 16, and we knew each other as pretty close friends pretty much up until we were 30. When we were 18, we went out for a while, for like just a couple months. We were going out together. And it was sort of a disaster. And what I didn't, I mean, I knew it at the time. I knew when I was 20, 22, 25, et cetera, that he wanted me back, that he wanted to go back to that, that he didn't like how it had ended and he didn't want anybody else, that sort of thing. What I didn't know is that he'd carried that for 30 years. He got back in touch with me. Well, I put a business card in a mailer when I was sending out flyers for a book, and he took 6 months to email me after he got that business card, and it just happened to come after I had started this book when I wasn't very far into it, and I was looking at my earliest sexual experiences, and of course he was one, and at first our correspondence wasn't about the book, except for I would say, I was remembering so-and-so today. Do you remember them? Because we had so many shared times in our life. And then things just started to progress where he started to admit to me how he felt, and I started to realize how important he was to me. I mean, after all, there's a couple of cartoons in the book that he wrote during a class we had together. I still had them. Well, what does that mean? Why did I keep these cartoons and all the letters I wrote to him that I Xeroxed and kept? For one thing, I kept them so I would remember they were like a journal. They were instead of a journal. But also, he was important to me in ways that I couldn't articulate. And so the relationship grew over email while I was writing the book. And what happened then is after the book was sold and I needed to revise it, I gave it to him to read and have some comments, and so then I was able to insert his comments during the reading of the finished manuscript. It is a little bit confusing because people tend to not read dates, but there are dated comments that he makes in the book, especially toward the end, which happen after the last scene of the book. So you can pick up from that my connection with Mark did continue after the last scene in the book, and as a matter of fact, he's downstairs right now.
I didn't want to give it away. Like, I didn't want to... Wait, he's downstairs?
He's downstairs with the dogs right now. He retired 2 years ago and moved to Illinois from California, and we started, as he would say, we started the life we should have had in the first place. It's you know, there's a lot of angst in him about what he missed. And so it's a very interesting journey, but we're pretty happy together.
Oh, my God, this is blowing my mind, Chris, because it is left at the end. I'm very unsure of what's going to happen at the end. And I was actually a little heartbroken too, that it didn't, I don't know, like at the very beginning, I thought, oh, I know where this is going. I know where this is going. It's going to be an amazing happy ending. And by the time I got through it, I was like, oh no, I don't think it went there. So this is like, this sort of like postscript is just, it's shocking and amazing.
Well, I edited the book there and we had not resolved anything as far as our, whether or not we were going to get together. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I can just write this book forever and it'll be, you know, 1,000, 2,000 pages, but it has to end somewhere and this is a pretty good ending. And then as I was editing it, we started to resolve some of our indecisions, and so that's why I have his voice still there after the date of the last scene. So if anybody cares, they can notice, hey, here he is. He's still talking about this. But as far as when, you know, he moved here after, well, just right before the book came out. So that's my new project that I'm working on. I'm working on a novella which it's a fictionalization of what his life was like during those 30 years, and then personal essays about the process of moving him here.
Wow. Okay. I just have to take a minute to digest this because, I mean, it's such a remarkable, I think what's so remarkable in the beginning about it is that you start to begin to have these feelings like maybe he was more important than I could articulate at the time. And when you finally reconnect with him, he's like, yo, that was really significant and you were really important to me. So there was this amazing, you know, because sometimes we can think that, like, I had this very strong connection with someone, but then it's decades later and you meet them and you're like, I don't even know who you are, right? Or you can't like reconnect. And it seemed like you guys reconnected and then were so on the same page for a lot of the book until it got kind of murky.
Yes, because even if you're in a marriage with somebody you don't love, as he was, leaving and knowing what you're going to do to that person is very hard, and so he had a difficult time with that decision, and there were some back and forth.
Yeah.
And so I just decided to leave it there because he wrote that. There's an email he wrote. But you know what? I did add 2 pages to the end of the book that was supposed to let people know that it wasn't just ending there. But maybe, I don't know if they were in the galley I sent you.
Maybe they're not in the galley that I read, because I felt very unsure of what was happening. I knew what I hoped would happen, but it was complicated. I mean, which is kind of how, you know, describes the whole book in kind of a nutshell. But okay, I'm going to take time to process this on a commercial break. We're going to hear from my great sponsor, Lilo. Thank you, Lilo, for sponsoring the show. I love you. I love your high-quality products, your amazing design, and your high-powered vibrator motors. Coming up, I'm going to process this, which is like more for me to process than any of you listeners. But when you read the book and then you think about this, it's going to blow your mind. Okay, so stay with us. More, wow, I really need to think about this now. Okay, more with Chris Mazza when we return.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
No fluff, no lies. Just real women talking real sex.
I am so bruised on my girl bits.
Sex gets real.
Sex gets so real.
So real up in here.
A weekly podcast with Dawn.
I just masturbated.
And Dylan.
Let's talk about the elusive clit.
With sex news.
Here's the thing about this female Viagra.
Interviews.
We have Cooper Beckett with us today. Lance Hart. Amy Jo Goddard.
Listener questions.
You won't know until you sit down and have that conversation.
And Dawn and Dylan sharing their own experiences.
I mean, it was just like sticking his tongue in there and trying to lick every crevice. It was awful.
Sometimes they share a little too much.
Ew, gross. Like, I don't even
I'm telling you, that's why I got grossed out.
Check them out on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and at sexgetsreal.com.
So gross. Okay.
So gross.
For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We're talking today with Chris Matza, the author of Something Wrong With Her, a hybrid memoir. And Chris, your sexuality plays a critical role in this memoir, and it's very complicated. I don't want to try to describe it myself. I want you to sort of sum it up for people, how you even identify today in your sexuality.
I probably have a different identification today even than when I finished the book.
Right.
I was writing this book to search why I had a dysfunctional sex life my entire life. So the other reading I read described the vaginismus and the pain. Before I ever even had sex, and by the way, when I mentioned that segment was about losing my virginity, I was 23, so I was not real young. I was pretty terrified of sex from the time I knew what it was. Until I lost my virginity. I was very anxious about it, and it's pretty easy to see how being so scared of it, of everything about it, would help cause that condition of the involuntary muscle contractions, which caused it to always be painful. But there was something else that I realized over my life that has been missing. As you probably know from one of the books that you were in that I edited, I have been known as a writer who is unflinching about sexuality, blah, blah, blah. But I really basically didn't know anything about sexuality because I had a completely dysfunctional sex life. I never had an orgasm. I had never masturbated. I had never been moved to masturbate, meaning I'd never had any kind of feelings like, oh, I need to do this. It wasn't that I thought it was bad. I was reading Erica Jong in college, and yet nothing prompted me. Nothing called out to me to be curious about myself, to touch myself, to do any of those things. And so the pain is one thing, and then the anorgasmia is another. And I never knew what people meant when they said they were horny. I was like, I don't really know what that means. I wonder if I've ever felt that, but apparently I hadn't. So that really hasn't changed my entire life, and I don't know if all the anxiety caused that too, but I have recently been asked about and then have done some modicum of research into asexuality. And, that's probably where I should put myself, but I don't like categories like that. And I know that the asexuality community does not want anybody saying that this is something wrong with you, the title of my book.
But, right.
I titled it that because all my life I was just kept telling myself, there's something wrong with you. You know, even like in high school, having a hot and heavy session in a car, which happened to be with Mark, at a drive-in, all I would tell myself is, you're supposed to like this. What's wrong with you? Because I didn't like it. So, yeah, there's been all these, you know, and I'm not afraid of sex. I stopped being afraid of sex after I lost my virginity. The only thing I was afraid of was that it was going to hurt.
Was the pain, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you had, it was like a sort of a confluence of things. You had a lack of desire. Then right. You would have these sexual situations where you wouldn't experience pleasure and you would sort of shame yourself, right? Like, what's wrong with me? It seems like everyone else is really digging this. And then you hadn't had an orgasm. And so it was kind of like all these things come together. And I was going to ask you about asexuality because, of course, that was not even on the map. I mean, the word didn't exist and no one spoke about anything like it. Back when you were first grappling and sort of coming into your sexual personhood. So I wondered in hindsight if you might identify yourself as asexual. But I also just want to acknowledge like that you talk about this in the book that, you know, women are often sort of encouraged to tell these sexual stories about themselves where they're naughty or promiscuous or just sort of, and people are titillated by them. Then people also call them sluts and say, and stigmatize those women, same women. But we have an expectation that when there's going to be a memoir about sex, it's going to be all about this sort of randy times. And so to read this brutally honest thing about this big element of your life that sort of just kept, you know, kept kind of rearing its head and kept feeling really unresolved was really intense. I mean, it was just really, really intense. And I wonder if you've gotten feedback from women who have vaginismus or who have lack of desire or who are anorgasmic. I mean, have people like come out of the woodwork and written to you and said, oh my God, I'm finally hearing some of my story?
Very few. I expected there might be more, but actually very few. When this book came out, I did, easily a dozen interviews, and there were three interviews on sex advice radio shows. And I expected, okay, this is going to do it. This is going to, you know, make people know the book is out there, and people who have this situation in their life, they're going to want to see. And they didn't. I mean, I'm not going to say the book didn't sell. It has sold as much as any other book I've written. But it didn't become that book that spoke for a bunch of people. And my publisher and I talked about it, and she said, I just think people are afraid to admit it.
Yes. I think the stigma is so big, and the shame and the guilt. But I think for people, if anyone has experienced anything like this, I feel like this book will give you permission to talk about it. Even with just one other person. I mean, I feel strongly about that. It's that those are the most moving parts. And the when you really lay yourself bare and remain curious. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things is that although to some extent in your marriages, you have this sort of shutdown, you remain curious throughout this memoir of really what is going on for me and what are the factors that kind of led me here, and you explore a number of different angles, and it all begins to really make sense, actually, all together. Like halfway through the book, I thought, okay, a lot of this is beginning to make sense because you had a series of early sexual experiences that were not great, and a series of relationships with men that were not ideal. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. Like you say, there wasn't this dramatic trauma that happened to you, but there was like little mini traumas happening to you over and over and over and over again, it seems like.
Yeah.
Does that ring true for you?
Yes, yes, that does. And I do say in the book that the things that happened to me aren't things that didn't happen to tens of thousands of girls growing up. And I don't mean to be saying that boys are animals. They have a different, you know, when their bodies are growing up, they are more feral, and they don't think about what they're doing, how what they're doing might affect somebody, and all they know is what they feel and what they want. And I do sometimes wonder if any of those boys think about how they, you know, chased me behind the stage when we were supposed to be practicing our instruments and held me still so they could feel my body, or the boy that was supposed to be my boyfriend who would play rape games on the way home from school and just say, see if you can get out of this one. I mean, none of these things ended up with rape, other than the digital penetration, but, you know, it was like, instead of being affectionate, he had to turn it into an assault. And I don't know if he was doing that because I was so stiff and resistant and unwilling, or if that was just how he expressed his sexuality, but having those kinds of experiences early, and again, I would tell myself, you're supposed to like this. I think all my friends like this. What's wrong with you? And I just didn't. But I wanted to have companionship in life. I knew I wasn't a lesbian because I didn't even want to touch my own body parts. So why would I want to touch somebody else's? Or another female's, I mean. And I wanted companionship, and it's just I happened to find two guys who were pretty inhibited when it came to their approach to sex. Excuse me, I'm going to have to cough.
Okay. Yeah, so everyone, Chris is actually really sick. She woke up this morning really sick, and she agreed to sort of go on. The show must go on. And she's really ill and not feeling well at all. And so I thank you, Chris, so that I didn't have to find like a substitute at the last minute. That really made my day less stressful. Okay, we got to take another break. I want to pick up on some of the things you said, but this seems like a good stopping point. And then you could also cough more. Okay. So let's take a break. And when we come back, more with Chris Matza.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in your brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
For years now, the Swedish-based designer brand Lilo has been at the forefront of pleasure product technology. Lilo's first product changed the way the adult industry thought about sex toy design upon its original release. With its sleek lines, its graceful shape, and its incredible performance, it was as much a piece of art as it was a pleasure product. Suddenly, Lilo had made it possible to perfectly blend form and function, and they continue to release groundbreaking products year after year. Since then, Lilo has only enhanced their reputation for quality and beauty, and now they lead the luxury industry thanks to a long heritage of innovation. Lilo is the hallmark of personal, intimate pleasure. Lilo is indulgent, sophisticated, elegant, and above all, intensely satisfying. Visit Lilo.com today to start exploring a new sensuality.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with Chris Mazza, an author of a million and one books, but her latest is a hybrid memoir called Something Wrong With Her. And what strikes me about what you said before the break is that you lost your virginity in 1981, right? And so arguably we've made some strides since then, right? And yet there is this retelling of these experiences as a young woman with young men that seem to echo some of the things I know I hear when I speak at college campuses, and which are certainly part of the discussions going on today about consent and about sexual communication and about sort of how we approach these erotic relationships without feeling like one person is sort of conquering the other one. Do you know what I mean? So do you feel like, as someone who also has access to college students, like a great deal has changed, or do you still see some of these same patterns between men and women happening?
Wow, I don't see my students interacting socially with each other. They don't come and tell me personal issues. Maybe I have one of those sort of screens up that says, "Don't go to her." I don't know. No, but I don't. And then my graduate students, for heaven's sakes, they're in their 30s and 40s, so that's a whole different game there. So no, the only thing I see is what I read about things happening, and you know that the girls seem a lot. I haven't read anything about girls being afraid of sex. That's just not something that I read. I certainly read a lot about girls being sexually assaulted mm-hmm. by men on campus, but I don't really read about girls who are virgins who are afraid of sex before anything has ever really happened. So I don't know. And again, I think it's something that is just too hard to admit, because you are so out of the mainstream of what our society deems to be important about people, and that is how sexy you are and how sexual you are. And I think, well, you know, in my case, there was some faking it, but if you look back through all of my books that were considered highly sexualized or highly sexual, it was a lot of dysfunctional sex going on in those books. And dark sex, not a lot of pleasurable, pleasant, affirming sex.
But this brings me to my next question, which is that one of the tensions in the book, I feel like, is one of the central themes is about your relationships with men. And that includes emotional relationships, professional relationships, romantic relationships, psychological relationships. So it's not just men who would be lovers or partners, but the men in your life are sort of orbiting around you and pretty laden with heavy power dynamics, with you not on the dominant end of those dynamics. Right. And I'm wondering how you sort of reconcile your clearly feminist identity with what seems like, you know, they get a lot of airtime in this book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's a real interesting question. And it's kind of caused me to give an answer that I hadn't really done a lot of deep thinking about. But if I was terrified of sex, and I know that one thing I consciously thought to myself, I need to, when I lose my virginity, I've got to be with a guy who's older than me, who's already had sex, so he knows what he's doing. So that whole thing about men who are older than me being able to teach me how to do things, sexual and otherwise, I think might have stemmed from that. None of it comes from an absent father. My father is 96 years old and he's still alive. And he was always present in my life, so none of it comes from that. But you know, you don't equate your father with thinking about who's going to initiate me into sex. And so I did think, okay, if it's an older guy, it won't be like these boys who are, you know, just so grabby and and selfish. And I think I must have just spread that out to everything else, that an older man was going to be able to get me ready to be an adult. But the other thing about this is I had all of one female professor in college. So it was a different world then and now. And it never caused me to think, oh, I can't be a writer. You know, I might have read all of one female writer, Edith Wharton, in college. That didn't make me think, oh, I can't be a writer or I can't be a professor because it's all men. But looking back, it was all men. So there's those two things, I think. And also, the thing that started me on this book, actually, was I wondered if my sex life would have been different if I hadn't experienced something when I was in college that now would have been called sexual harassment. And I realized sexual harassment didn't exist then as a crime or as a something you could sue over.
Right, so sexual harassment back then was not part of a public dialogue. It wasn't being named. It wasn't being codified. It wasn't being litigated by any means. And that is one lens that you sort of look through to explore your sexuality, is there were a lot of men being, let's just say, really fucking inappropriate with you.
Yeah. And yet, my thought was, well, if he'd just gone ahead and took me somewhere and had sex with me, maybe everything in my life would have been different. And I'm speaking of the guy who was my supervising teacher when I was learning to be a high school teacher, which I never became. Some people would equate that with the fact that he was more interested in guiding my sexuality than my teaching, but I really was a terrible high school teacher. But so it's extremely unfeminist of me to say, oh gosh, if only that had happened, maybe my whole life would have been different. I think I've decided that's probably not true. But that's how I started writing the book, looking at that.
And we've only got a couple minutes left, but I wanted to say also that one of the most compelling parts of your story is that one of these sort of grabby sexual experiences happened with Mark. Very, 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 I mean, you were 16 years old. I mean, it was, it almost reads like a sort of typical 16-year-old fumbling sort of sexual encounter. But I wonder how, but it feels like you found a way to heal from that. Both of you did. Is that true?
Mark feels like that was the mistake that destroyed his life. That's how he would put that. That if he hadn't, he says he was acting the way other boys had influenced him, that making him think he needed to act that way. He said that wasn't like him, but his friends had been saying things to him and about what he was supposed to do. And of course, he had all those feelings that they had in their bodies. But he considers that the hugest mistake of his life. I don't ever think about that anymore. He is, it's hard to describe. He's my soulmate. Just getting back together was like going home. And even though sex has been difficult, we've figured out what we can do and what we can't do. I think we're going to make it, but I can't do anything about his huge regrets that are still there. And that particular scene is one of them.
I mean, life is messy, right?
Yeah.
And you guys have to read this book, because if just this hour gave you any taste, there's a lot in it. And now you know that there is a happy ending, which is really special. Thanks so much, even being sick, for spending the hour with us, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I enjoyed myself.
Chris Motza is the author of 16 books, including her hybrid memoir, Something Wrong With Her. Find out more at chris-motza.com. We will tweet that out. Follow her on Facebook and Twitter at Chris Motza Author. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, segment producer and editor Colton, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my engineer, and everyone at Voice America. If you missed any part of the show or want to hear it again, you can listen on demand or download the MP3 by going to voiceamerica.com and searching for Sex Out Loud. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast on iTunes. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, when my guest will be Deborah Kagan, educator, author, and sensual lifestyle specialist. She's going to talk all about how to become more sensually empowered. Until then, hit me up on facebook.com/asktristan, on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio, and talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.